Hi, friends. How are you doing today? I really hope that you guys are having the day that you deserve. My name's Carly Ramsey, and you are listening to the Serial Zodiac. I'm so excited that you're here and that you're wanting to listen to this episode. So, with that being said, I don't want to lollygag on too long, but I will be here for you guys every other Thursday to push you out new content. So, that being said, let's jump right into today's story. Thanks, guys. Hello, friends. Welcome to today's episode. I thought that you guys kind of just deserved a little, a little warning, a little notice before hopping into this episode. So today's episode is going to be about Albert Fish. And this one's a doozy, guys. So she's going to be a two-parter because Albert is very, very disturbed. He's a very, very disturbed man. So because of that, I decided to make this a two-parter. So this part one is out today. And then the next episode that drops, not next Thursday, but the next, will be part two of Albert and all of his sickness. That being said, I want to warn you guys about this episode heavily, 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 heavily. This is probably one of the most disturbing episodes that I've ever talked about on this podcast. This one, I had a lot of sleepless nights covering it. There is a letter. It's a very famous letter. It's a very graphic letter. And I read that letter in full in this episode. I apologize in advance for that. And there is literally everything in this episode. There is murder. There is molestation. There is molestation of children. There is dismemberment. There is cannibalism. So that's your warning. Get ready. Here's Albert. A person's childhood is crucial. It decides what the person is going to be like when they grow up. But what happens when a man experiences the worst possible horrors in his childhood? Well, it messes with your head. It leads you to experiencing sick thoughts and feelings. And while one may end up hurting themselves, it doesn't end there. Soon, a sick-minded man might start hurting innocent people. And in the most gruesome cases, even children. This is the story of Albert Fish, a man who wasn't just a murderer. He would molest, decapitate, and in one famous case, even eat. Yeah, you heard that right. Eat the remains of innocent young children. To understand where his behavior really came from, we've got to go right back to the start. Born Hamilton Howard Fish on May of 1870 in Washington, D.C., his parents were Randall Fish and Ellen Frances Howell. Now, Randall, who was 70 years old when Hamilton was born, was quite the senior compared to Ellen. He was 43 years older, to be exact. That age gap alone would raise some massive eyebrows in today's day. But I guess the product of this marriage was much worse than the marriage itself. Hamilton was the baby of the family, with three siblings, Walter, Annie, and Edwin. All right, so Albert Fish was born on May 19th of 1870, and he was a Taurus, you guys. Now, Tauruses are known for being stubborn, determined, and sensual, but they've got a dark side too. Picture this. Hamilton, we'll later understand where the name Albert came from, with his methodical planning and patience, fits right into the Taurus profile. Plus, Tauruses can be possessive, which could have fueled Fish's desires. And get this, Tauruses are ruled by Venus, the planet of love and pleasure. So his sick fantasies may have been influenced by that need for indulgence. It's not to say that astrology explains everything, but it sure does add a layer to understanding the mind of a killer. So now that we got that out of the way, let's go right back into Albert's childhood. So, he had a rough start to his life, and he spent a chunk of his childhood in an orphanage. He loathed his nickname, Ham and Eggs, and preferred to go by Albert. And Albert came after a deceased family. A deceased sibling. Oh my gosh. Albert came from his deceased sibling. So now you're probably wondering, he just woke up one day and decided he wanted to go by his deceased sibling's name because he didn't like Ham and Eggs being his nickname? The answer to that question is yes. Yes, he did. So, his family tree was pretty messed up right from the start. Mental illness ran deep. His uncle had mania, one brother was institutionalized, another dealt with schizophrenia, and even his sister Annie had her own mental struggles. A few other relatives had their share of mental issues, and get this, his mom even experienced hallucinations. It was like as soon as he was born, he knew the odds would not be in his favor. So, to keep down on confusion for the rest of this episode, I'm actually just going to refer to Hamilton as Albert, so that way nobody gets confused. So, Hamilton, Albert, we're strictly going by Albert now. So, when Albert was just 5, things went completely wrong. His dad passed away from a heart attack, and with him gone, his mom had to put him in St. John's Orphanage. So when Albert was 5, his dad would have been 75. But his dad passed away from a heart attack, and his mom ended up putting him in St. John's Orphanage, where things got pretty rough. So Albert had endured physical abuse there, but oddly enough, he kind of enjoyed it. So this abuse that he experienced wasn't just normal abuse. The caretakers were known for taking the children's clothes off and either whipping them or beating them in front of each other. And this was known as a form of shame punishment. But instead of making Albert feel shameful, it was a starting point of a desire within Albert where he wanted to inflict pain and suffer it himself as well. Disturbingly, watching these beatings of other children soon began to arouse Albert, but he didn't reveal this part until years later after he was caught. So let's just take a beat and talk about St. John's Orphanage. St. John's Orphanage, I did a lot of research, not just on St. John's, but on orphanages, period, during this time. And it turns out that orphanages, period, during this time, just weren't a desirable place for children to have to go. So it just wasn't a desirable place for children to go. Like, literally in one instance in one of the articles that I was reading, and I will link the article in the show notes, but one of the articles that I was reading, this girl recalls basically seeing a nun push another child off of, like, I guess, like, it was a balcony. And she literally, like, states that the body, like, bounced. Like, it went up and then it came down and hit the ground again. And she's walking with another nun and she just kind of looks up at her and she's like, "Sister." And the nun looks at her, grabs her ear, and is like, "I think someone needs to learn a lesson." And I basically just, I guess, proceeds to go and beat her. Orphanages, horrible place for children back then. So Albert endured a lot. It was even at one point said that these nuns, mind you, these are like children. Albert is 5 at this time. So these are like babies still. So it's said that sometimes these orphanages would even like make the children eat their own throw up. So the kids would like get sick from like the conditions and like different things, and they were like crying so much too, and they would get sick and throw up, and the nuns would make them eat their own throw up, which later on we'll see how that kind of had an effect on him too. But to make matters much worse, the caretakers also forced the children to hurt each other. The impact of this was deeply embedded into Albert, that he went on to encourage this behavior in his own kids later in life. And because there was no formal education at this orphanage, Albert had no way to escape from the torture of this regular abuse. Now, by 1880, Albert's mom had gotten herself a government job and had gotten him out of the place. But life didn't get any less strange. And also by this point, those were like his developmental years. So you could see how this would have affected him deeply. Now, I know you guys are going to say, "Carly, why does it sound like you're sticking up for him? We understand he had a bad life, but that doesn't give him the right to do whatever it is that he did to end up on this podcast." And to that, I will say, you are right, but I do like to try to get into their minds to try to kind of understand maybe where they were going with this, because I personally just can't believe that people are inherently born evil. I feel like everyone is born this little angel and then the world warps them into what they are. So that's what I'm trying to do with Albert. I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, but he made it real hard, guys. He made it so hard. I'm not excusing any of his actions, but he did have a horrible childhood. But nonetheless, at 12, he got comfortable with a telegraph boy. And this boy influenced him into doing some pretty messed up things. But remember and think back after I say this. So this boy introduced him to drinking pee and eating poop. So, I mean, hear me out. You were already ingesting your own throw up. The nuns were making you eat it back in the orphanage. So I feel like, don't shoot the messenger on this one. Eating your own feces and drinking pee, it's not a far cry from there. Like, you're already eating redigested food that was supposed to go out the other way. What's the difference? Don't shoot the messenger. So, he's eating and drinking his own feces now, at the age of 12. But Albert also had this weird habit of hitting up public bath houses to watch other boys strip down. So I know a lot of my listeners, some of you might not know what a bathhouse is, but essentially it's just this, how is a nice way of explaining this? A good way of explaining a bathhouse is essentially like a spa, but it's usually like, bathhouses are usually like for men, the ones that Albert was going to was for men. And most of the times they were for gay men, and people would go there and enjoy the spa like area. Basically, think of just like your regular spa. Yeah, your regular spa. And that's as far as I'm going to go into that one. It's a spa that's not co-ed. It's just men. The women's side doesn't exist. So, the worst of all of this was that he also had a thing for writing filthy letters to women that he found in ads or matchmaking services. So, you're probably thinking to yourself, ads? Like the ads in the paper. I know we don't really read papers now, but it was like classified ads. And back then, people were like, I guess, deathly afraid of being single. Women were like afraid to be single because they were like really harshly judged if they were single. So they would write in the classified ads to try to find a boyfriend and a husband. They would be like, oh my gosh, like I'm so lovely and I know how to cook and clean. Please bury me. And Albert was responding to these ads, but with some pretty messed up things. Now, he was way too young to be inclined towards such things, but later in life, Albert admitted that the orphanage was the reason that he got so messed up in the head. And the orphanage birthed a sinister part of Albert. And after that part of him was born, he was just never really able to suppress it or suppress those urges that he got from there. So I'll be telling y'all, treat your kids good. In 1890, when Albert was 20, he made his way to New York City, but things took a dark turn. As Albert started getting involved in male prostitution, he couldn't control the urge that made him molest and rape young boys. And when I say young, you're probably thinking, how old are you talking? Well, they were mostly always younger than six. Fast forward to 1898, and Albert's mom actually kind of noticed that he was like a little weird. So she set him up with a marriage to Anna Mary Hoffman, who was 9 years younger than him. And this is a great age gap considering his parents' age gap. So Albert and Anna ended up having a whopping six kids. Albert, Anna, Gertrude, Eugene, John, and Henry. But in 1903, Albert found himself in a world of trouble. He got nabbed for grand larceny and got thrown behind bars in Sing Sing. After he got out, at some point, one of his male lovers took him to a wax museum that really fascinated him. But what was so fascinating about it? You see, he saw a bisection of a human penis, and it appealed him so much that he got deeply obsessed with sexual mutilation. I don't know what wax museum he went to, but I have only ever been to one in Vegas. And let me tell you, there was no cross-section of a penis. And I am grateful that there was not. I don't know what that wax museum he went to. Like, where they're showing you cross-sections of penises. Maybe it was like a body wax museum. But anyway. So, then around 1910, Albert was working in Wilmington, Delaware. He crossed paths with a 19-year-old guy named Thomas Bedden. They developed a relationship with each other, and that was based on inflicting and receiving pain. But what happened next was just unbelievable. Albert took Bedden to his rundown farm and tormented him for 2 whole weeks. After that, he eventually tied him up and then he cut half of his penis off. Albert later said that he'd never forget the screams or the look in Bedden's face. Originally, he had planned to kill him, cut his body into pieces, and take off. But Albert said he chickened out because he was scared he would get caught. So instead, he patched up the wounds, left some cash, and ran. He basically took a train back home and never looked back to see what became of Bedden. The worst part of it all is that nobody's sure if their relationship was even consensual. Did Albert force him into their sadomasochistic relationship? The only thing that people do know is that through Albert's testimony, Bedden was intellectually disabled. And in today's day, his consent wouldn't even count as actual consent. Oh, Albert is just a piece of shit. Moving on, though. But if you think that this is bad enough, wait until you hear about what happened next. In January of 1917, Albert's life took a nosedive when his wife left him for a handyman named John, I'm just going to say it, Straboon. I can't say his name. And this handyman actually lived with them. So suddenly, Albert found himself having to navigate single parenthood and raising all of their children on his own. Mind you, 6 kids. So now he's just like a single father. But that didn't stop him. He still found time. So he found himself having to navigate single parenthood, raising all their kids alone. And Anna, to add insult to injury, when she split, she pretty much cleared out the entire house, taking everything that wasn't bolted to the floor, leaving Albert with absolutely nothing to fall back on. She even took the children's beds, which, like, girl, why did you need that? You didn't take the kids. Why did you need their beds? Like, be for real right now. So things didn't just stop here. Albert actually started hearing voices, like actual auditory hallucinations. And at one point, he had wrapped himself up in a carpet, claiming he was following the orders of John the Apostle. And that's not even the half of it. Around this time, Albert began some seriously disturbing habits, like sticking needles into his own body, his groin, and abdomen, to be exact. So, Albert, this day where he like rolled himself up into the carpet, I read where like one of his kids like came down the stairs and she like saw him. And I can't remember if she like said something to him or not, like it, or if she was just like, ah, he's being weird again, and just walked back up the stairs. But he like got on the floor, rolled himself up in the carpet, and then proceeded to sleep there all night. And she like basically she came down the stairs, saw him. I can't remember if she said something or if she just went back upstairs. I think she did say something, because that's when he would tell her that John Apostle told him to do it. So she goes back upstairs, comes down the next morning, and he's just now unwrapping himself. Crazy. So, these needles that he was sticking into himself, the exact spot he was actually sticking those needles in was the taint. The area between his anus and his balls, that area was the area that he would stick pins in. So when he got arrested, the doctors had did some x-rays and they found 29 whole needles in his pelvic area. But Albert wasn't just content with that level of self-harm. He went ahead and started hitting himself with a paddle with studded nails. And if that's not messed up enough, he even went as far as, I'm so sorry, I'm about to say this. He even went as far as inserting a wool soaked in lighter fluid into his own anus and setting it on fire. So here's where things take a really dark turn. Albert may not have physically hurt his kids, but he sure didn't shy away from involving them in his twisted rituals. So he actually encouraged them and their friends to paddle his behind with the same nail-studded paddle he used on himself. It was said when they were younger, one of his daughters testified that they would frequently like play this game where he would basically close his eyes and they would hold up a number of fingers and he would try to guess the fingers and he would always get them wrong. Like literally sometimes he would say more fingers than they even had on their hands. And whenever he would get it wrong, they would paddle him with the paddle. And say, for example, he said they had 11 fingers and they had 9 fingers up. They would give him a paddle for each finger. I'm so sorry. I deeply apologize. I was just as disturbed while doing research for this. So, it was very clear that Albert was losing his sanity, but unfortunately, this was only the beginning. In 1919, Albert did something really chilling. He stabbed a mentally disabled boy in Georgetown. Now, I've been kind of telling you about how Albert has slowly been losing his sanity, I guess, but he was smart enough to, he was smart enough to specifically target folks who were either mentally disabled or African American. And why, might you ask? Well, Albert thought to himself that no one would notice if these people disappeared, and if he could get away with his actions not being noticed, he could continue to carry out his sick fantasies without being caught and jailed. So he might have been crazy, but he wasn't too crazy to rationally think that one out. Like, nobody's going to care about the mentally disabled and the black people. But there's always a but with Albert. But it gets even darker. Albert later admitted to sometimes paying boys to find him more victims. I mean, who does that? It's beyond messed up. And then there were his tools of terror, the, and I quote, implements of hell, as he called them. These implements of hell were a meat cleaver, a butcher knife, and a small handsaw. It's like he had his own personal horror toolkit. Now, fast forward to July 11th of 1924, when Albert stumbled upon 8-year-old Beatrice Keel. I think that's how you pronounce the last name. Playing alone on her family's farm in Staten Island. He lured her in with the promise of money to help him find Rubbard. And luckily, her mom caught wind of his creepy behavior and chased him off. But he didn't easily give up. Later that day, he snuck back in to Beatrice's barn, trying to hide out. But he was discovered by Beatrice's father, who forced him to leave. It was said that the father beat him, rightfully so. But if this teaches you guys anything, tell your children that an adult should never be asking for their help, ever. An adult should not need your help as a child. What can you help them with? Because these people were a little too trusting. So even before his famous abduction case, he tried out his sickening tools on a 10-year-old kid named Carol Quinn. Quinn and his friend were just playing outside when Albert lured them into his apartment with promises of lunch. But things quickly took a turn when they stumbled upon Albert's stash of weapons hidden under his mattress. Terrified, they ran out of there as fast as they could. So, good for them. Now, despite already being married, Albert went ahead and got married to Estella Wilcox in February of 1930, but their marriage didn't even last a week before they called it quits. And if you thought that was bizarre, Albert was arrested in May of 1930 for sending a seriously messed up letter to a woman who responded to a job ad. Following that incident and another arrest in 1931, he was thrown into Bellevue Hospital for evaluation. They noticed something was terribly wrong with Albert, but despite that, he managed to remain free to do whatever he wanted. And this led to one of the most brutal murders in history. Before we get into that murder, I kind of want to explain to you the messed up letter that they're referring to, that he responded, that the woman had responded to. So Albert would frequently respond to these ads in the paper, and sometimes it was like asking for them to stay. And in this particular one, he was asking to basically stay at this, it was an apartment, I believe, but he was essentially like asking, could he stay there? And he was explaining to them that he had a disabled cousin. I think it was a cousin or a brother. I can't remember if it was a cousin or a brother, but basically there was someone disabled. So he would go into detail, telling these people like, this is like how this person needs to be punished. And like if they do something bad, and he would go into like graphic detail. And if they like, one of them happened to like respond back, and he, sometimes when they would respond back, essentially, it wasn't just one, it was a few of them that responded back, because most of them would kind of fall off after, you know, he wrote them and said that this is how you need to punish this disabled person. When they would respond back, he would offer to meet them in person to see if they had what it takes to discipline. And if they responded back okay, or like something along those lines, he would basically sometimes like show up and like expect them to perform these crazy acts on him. Yeah. So he was actually thrown into Bellevue Hospital, but Albert would actually later go on to say that he kind of basically like knew how to get out of this. Like, he, Albert was a smart cookie. He was smart. Like, yes, he had mental health issues, but his mental health issues weren't so debilitating to where like, ah, he's crazy. Like, he knew what he was doing. He knew. But like I said, despite all these things, he remained free, and it led to one of the most brutal murders in history. On May 25th of 1928, Albert stumbled upon a classified ad in the New York World, and it was from a young guy named Edward Budd. Now, Edward was looking for a gig out in the country, and Albert, then 58, saw this as an opportunity for his sick plans. So he pretended to be a farmer named Frank Howell from Farmingdale, New York, and he showed up at the Budd family's place in Manhattan. So his original plan was to kidnap Edward and tie him up and mutilate him and then leave him to die. Things were planned pretty well in his head, but essentially it didn't go to plan. So Edward's friend also kind of showed up and was like, hey, like, can I join? And Albert, I'm not one to shy away from hard work, is he? Albert was like, sure. And so he kind of had to change his plan from just murdering Edward, let's just say what it is, murdering Edward, to now murdering Edward and his friend. So this kind of made Albert a day late. So he was kind of like, like, I'm going to be there the next day. And so he showed up the next day. And when he showed up, things got even more twisted. So when Albert got there, he shifted gears and set his sights on Edward's 10-year-old sister, Grace. He spun some story about needing to go to his niece's birthday bash and managed to talk Grace's parents into letting her tag along. Now, before we start judging Grace's parents, you really have to think of the position that they were in. Their son and his friend had gotten the opportunity of a lifetime to go work on this farm. And these, like, doing this type of job was a city boy's dream. Like, not trying to be funny, but like, it was literally like a boy who grew up in the city. They longed for country air, and him and his friend were just so excited about this job. And they're thinking like, oh, we've met the guy. Like, he's really nice. Like, little did they know. He's really nice. And I mean, this is like our son's new employer and we don't really want to mess up anything for him. I'm not saying if I were a parent, I would have did it. But what I am saying is that I can see it from their point of view. Okay? Don't shoot the messenger. So, he talked Grace's parents into letting her tag along. But little did they know, they were sending her straight into the hands of a monster. Albert took Grace away to an abandoned house he had had his eye on, a place he had planned to use for his next kill. And it's chilling to think about how close she was to danger without even realizing it. So once they got into the house, well, let's backtrack. So he takes Grace under the guise of he's going to take her to this party. He then takes her to this house. He kind of just tells her like, hey, Grace, like, you can go outside, play, and then when I call you, just come in. So Albert had went in the house and he undresses fully. So that way, he didn't want to get blood on his clothes. So he undresses and he's naked. And then he kind of hides in the corner and then he calls her up because he knew that if she saw him naked, she would immediately turn around and run away. He didn't want her to do that. So he kind of hid in the corner, he called her up. And once she got up there, Albert strangled Grace to death. After he strangled her, he cut her body into pieces and dismembered it. He then ate the remains over the next several days. Now, here's where things take a surprising turn. The police end up arresting a 66-year-old superintendent named Charles Edward Poe on September 5th in 1930, thinking that he had something to do with Grace's disappearance. Now, it turns out that it was all based on accusations from Poe's estranged wife. And he spent over 3 months in jail before his trial, but in the end, he was found not guilty. And after this, years went by with no word about the actual culprit behind Grace's disappearance. And then a letter emerged. It was November 1934 when a letter was sent anonymously to Grace's parents. Her mother was illiterate and couldn't read the letter, so her son read it out loud to her. What I'm about to read out to you is word for word what this letter had to say. So please, if you are faint of heart, if you cannot deal with disturbing things, please skip this part. Word for word. My dear Mrs. Budd, in 1894, a friend of mine shipped as a deckhand on the steamer Tacoma. Captain John Davis. They sailed from San Francisco to Hong Kong, China. On arriving there, he and two others went ashore and got drunk. When they returned, the boat was gone. At that time, there was a famine in China. Meat of any kind was from $1 to $3 a pound. So great was the suffering among the very poor that all children under 12 were sold to butchers to be cut up and sold for food to keep others from starving. a boy or girl under 14 was not safe in the street. You could go into any shop and ask for steak, chops, or stew meat. Part of the naked body of a boy or girl would be brought out and just what you wanted cut from it. A boy or girl behind, which is the sweetest part of the body, and sold as a veal cutlet bought at the highest price. John stayed there so long that he acquired a taste for human flesh. On his return to New York, he stole two boys, 1 7 and 1 11, took them to his home, stripped them naked, tied them in a closet, and then burned everything they had on. Several times every day and night, he spanked them and tortured them to make their meat good and tender. First, he killed the 11-year-old boy because he had the fattest ass and, of course, the most meat on it. Every part of his body was cooked and eaten except his head, bones, and guts. He was roasted in the oven, all of his ass boiled, broiled, fried, stewed. The little boy was next and went the same way. At that time, I was living at 409 East 100th Street, rear right side. He told me so often how good human flesh was, I made up my mind to taste it. On Sunday, June 3rd, 1928, I called you at 406 West 15th Street, brought you pot cheese, strawberries. We had lunch. Grace sat in my lap and kissed me. I made up my mind to eat her, on the pretense of taking her to a party. You said, yes, she could go. I took her to an empty house in Westchester. I had already picked out. When we got there, I told her to remain outside. She picked wildflowers. I went upstairs and stripped all my clothes off. I knew if I did not, I would get her blood on them. When all was ready, I went to the window and called her. Then I hid in a closet until she was in the room. When she saw me, all naked, she began to cry and tried to run downstairs. I grabbed her, and she said she would tell her mama. First, I stripped her naked. How she did kick, bite, and scratch. I choked her to death, then cut her into small pieces so I could take my meat to my rooms, cook it, and eat it. How sweet and tender her little ass was roasted in the oven. It took me 9 days to eat her entire body. I did not fuck her, though I could have had I wished. She died a virgin. Now, you probably need a minute to absorb everything that Albert had to say about his murder. One wonders what made him reach out to Grace's parents. Why couldn't he just let it go like all the previous times he did such acts? The letter became one of the most crucial leads in trying to locate Grace's killer. And so the police began their investigation. The story concerning Captain Davis and the famine were never verified. But all of the details about Grace's kidnapping and the events that happened afterwards were accurate. But keep in mind that it was nearly impossible to confirm if Albert had eaten Grace's flesh or not. To this day, the only way people know that Albert is a possible cannibal is through this letter. And through this same letter, Albert was finally caught. You know, psychologists have been digging into Albert's life since he got caught, trying to wrap their head around how someone could turn out so twisted. They figured out that Albert's messed up childhood played a big role. His old man and other kids were downright brutal to him. And the more pain he suffered, the more he seemed to like it. It's like he got hooked on hurting and wanted to spread the misery. Eventually, causing pain became Albert's way of letting off steam. Part of his criminal defense was that he unintentionally ejaculated twice while killing Grace Budd, even though he did not sexually assault her. He simply was stimulated by the act of torture. Okay, so I don't know if you guys knew this, but there are like different types of serial killers. Some serial killers enjoy the things like leading up to the murder. So they enjoy like the stalking part of it and the catching part of it and the kidnapping part of it. But then there's some who simply just like murdering to murder. So they do enjoy, like, they get some pleasure out of like the kidnapping. They get a lot of pleasure out of the torturing, but they get most of their pleasure out of the actual like act of killing. And some would argue that these types of serial killers are possibly the most dangerous simply because they kill, simply put, because they like it. Whereas the other types of serial killers, some of them like have even stated that they don't really like the act of murder. They just kind of like everything that happens before it. So just to give you a little insight. So eventually, causing pain became Albert's way of letting off steam. Like I said, part of his criminal defense was that he actually unintentionally ejaculated twice while killing Grace Budd, even though he didn't sexually assault her. He simply was stimulated by that act of torture. It wasn't just him, though. It seems like mental illness ran in the family. His uncle, brother, sister, heck, even his mom had their own issues. Back then, mental health wasn't taken as seriously. So who knows how many others in the family were struggling. With a genetic roller coaster like that, no wonder Albert's mental health took a nosedive after all the trauma he faced as a kid. Then there was his dad's strict, Covenantist upbringing. It warped Albert's sense of right and wrong pretty badly. He thought that he was doing God's work, like some divine hitman. His dad used religion to justify the abuse, and it left Albert terrified of God's wrath for the rest of his life. Plus, Albert was fixated on this Bible story about Abraham. So he thought sacrificing young boys would earn him brownie points with God. He even believed that angels would swoop in if he messed up. And as if that wasn't enough, some people reckon his cannibalism was his way of getting closer to God, like some kind of sick communion. Now, after Albert was caught, the truth emerged about what he had done to Grace. But here's the thing. More cases began to emerge, all of which were probably carried out by Albert. Albert denied being involved in any other killings, but suspicions swirled around him for a sleuth of other murders. Detective William King even thought that he was the notorious Brooklyn Vampire, a murderer and rapist who was known for targeting kids and teens in and around New York City. Take Yetta, I'm going to butcher her last name, but Abramoffswa, for example. She was just 12 when she was strangled and beaten on a Bronx rooftop back in 1927. Sadly, she passed away shortly after being discovered. Witnesses reported seeing a man who looked a lot like Albert trying to lure young girls into dark spots around the neighborhood on the very same day Yetta died. Then there's Mary Ellen O'Connor, a 16-year-old whose body was found near the house that Albert had been working on in Far Rockaway, Queens, in 1932. Now, Albert himself boasted about sexually abusing over 100 boys, mostly African Americans or those with developmental disabilities. I told you guys earlier, he said that it would help him not to get caught. And based off the claims that he's now making, it now seems to have worked. But these are things that he claims to do, but they don't really have any proof of those 100 boys. So he claimed that he targeted them because he thought the cops wouldn't dig too deep into the attacks on kids like them. And get this, he bragged about offing a kid in each of the 23 states that he lived in. His possible victims included Thomas Benton around 19 years back in 1910. Then there's Emma Richardson, just 5 years old, who lost her life in 1926. Emil Alling, a mere 4 years old, met a tragic end in 1930, and the list goes on. Robin Jane Liu, 6 years old in 1931, Benjamin Collins, 17 in 1932. But one gruesome murder was soon confirmed to be his doing, and if you want to find out which murder that was, you are going to have to stick around for part two, and you will find out. Whoa, that was a crazy episode, guys. I am so sorry. But I warned you. So there will be a part two. It's coming out. You just gotta wait for it. But in the meantime, if you want to keep up with me and everything that I'm doing, I now have a YouTube channel and ta-da! I also have a website that you guys can go to my website, theserialzodiac.com, and sign up for my email list. You will be informed of new episodes when they drop. You'll be informed of just news in general about my podcast. And oh my gosh, I'm so excited to tell you guys about this. And starting next month, every month, I will be having special guests on my podcast. Ah, so excited, right? I am so excited to be offering these little special episodes for you guys. So I love doing the episodes bi-weekly. It helps me definitely keep up with recording them and keeping myself accountable. But I just felt like you guys deserved more from me. So every month, a specialty episode will be dropping starting next month with a special guest. And they'll always be different guests. And I already have the first three guests picked out. So I'm so excited for you guys to hear about them and to just hear me and the guests talking about this. I'm super excited, guys. So that being said, go sign up for my email list so that way you can always stay informed. If you don't know where my email list is, once again, it's theserialzodiac.com. Or you can go to any of my socials, Carly.Ramsey, R-M-S-Y, or you can go to any of the Serial Zodiac pages, click the links in those bios, and click on the website, and you'll be able to sign up for that email through there. Thank you so, 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 so much for listening to my episodes and supporting me. You guys are incredible. You make me so happy and you keep motivating me to come back and continuing to give you this content because I knew I wasn't the only person who was obsessed with true crime. But that being said, thank you so much again. I appreciate you so much. And I cannot wait to see you on part two. Bye-bye. I hope you're having the day that you deserve.